Welcome to Crime Conversations, the true crime podcast brought to you by CrimeCon UK, the ultimate true crime weekend. In the lead up to CrimeCon in London on September 25th and 26th, each week we're bringing two of our favourite podcasts together to find out more about their fascination with true crime. Each conversation will explore subjects including how they got involved in true crime, the cases that have stuck in their mind, the process behind their podcast, and what they think makes a great true crime show. We'd also like to say a big thank you to all those true crime fans who sent questions to ask our guests. To find out who we'll be featuring on the podcast across the season, and for more information on our London event, check crimecon.co.uk or visit our Instagram page at crimecon_UK. Let's find out who's on this episode.
August 17th, 1992, Waukegan, Illinois. While babysitting two children, 11-year-old Holly Staker is sexually assaulted and murdered inside her apartment. 2 months later, a suspect named Juan Rivera confesses to the crime. He is subsequently convicted and receives a life sentence. However, since no physical evidence linked Rivera to the murder and the veracity of his confession is called into question, he would undergo two separate retrials before his conviction is vacated for good. DNA evidence would link Holly Staker's murder to the death of a man named Delwin Foxworth, and it's possible that another innocent person is serving time in prison for this crime. After that, the trail went cold.
How you doing tonight, Robin?
Just great, Aaron. How about yourself?
Well, I'm doing fantastic now that you're here.
Yes, thank you. And I'm thrilled that you asked me how I'm doing tonight.
It's funny. We've talked a number of times, always at CrimeCon, it seems. And so it seemed like this was just a natural progression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like we've done a live show together at the Royal Cinema in Toronto on the same stage, had a number of conversations at social events. So it's great that we're finally getting together to record a podcast episode.
And I had let it slip to some of the listeners when I was doing a voice chat hangout thing that I was going to be doing a podcast with a Canadian podcaster. And the only name that got thrown out was yours. And two of the people actually said, wow, if Robin was on with you, that would be awesome.
Oh, that's awesome. That's sweet. And I love that I'm the first podcaster they think of when they think Canadian.
I did not tell them if they were correct or not.
It'll surprise them when they hear it.
Yes. So tonight we have a mystery on our hands, but also kind of a somber case. I mean, any case that involves the murder of a young child is something that's difficult to think about, at least from my point of view. And I try to spread cases like this out because it does take a toll.
Yeah, this one is particularly brutal because it involves the murder of an 11-year-old girl named Holly Staker. And I covered it on The Trail Went Cold about 4 years ago, and it's always stuck with me because not only was an innocent man wrongfully convicted of this crime, but as part of their strategy for the state strategy to keep him in prison, they almost had to smear the victim's reputation rather than admit that they had put the wrong person in prison.
Oftentimes when we cover a case like this, Justin and I will leave it kind of a mystery as we go on. But I think we don't need to do that on this one simply because we've also had people write in and ask us, what is the worst wrongful conviction you can think of? And if this isn't it, then this is up there.
Oh, definitely. Like, I remember when I released this episode 4 years ago, a lot of my listeners had never heard of it and were just shocked by some of the things I revealed. And it also qualifies as an unsolved mystery, too, because we technically don't know who committed this horrific crime.
One of the questions that I often have in my head when I cover a case like this is this a case of the police and the prosecution going with the evidence that they prefer that really stands out to them or their gut instincts? Or is this a case where they probably know what really happened, but they press on because they feel like they can get a conviction?
Well, I think at the outset, they may have legitimately believed they got the right person. But as time went on, they just kept ignoring so much evidence that they had got the wrong guy and just stayed true to their path. And that's why this case became such an embarrassing debacle.
Now, this case takes place in Waukegan, Illinois, does it not?
Yes, it does.
And it happened on August 17th, 1992.
Yes, and the victim was 11-year-old Holly Staker. And that particular night, she was babysitting the two children of one of her neighbors named Don Engelbrecht. And she had a 5-year-old son named Blake and a 2-year-old daughter named Taylor.
Now, what did police find when they arrived at the apartment building? And this was a 2-story apartment building on Hickory Street, which is in the north part of Waukegan.
Yes, that's correct. And what had happened is that the boy Blake had been playing outside for a while. And when he tried to return to the house, he found out it was locked, the front door, and they would not answer his knocks. So he became concerned enough that he went to see his mother at work. She was working that night at a tavern. And when Don attempted to phone the house, Holly would not answer. So she became concerned enough to contact Holly's mother. And they met together at the apartment. And when they went inside, they found the daughter, Taylor. She was okay. She was just hanging around by herself. But Holly had been stabbed 27 times. She had been partially clothed and also been strangled and sexually assaulted.
That's a very difficult scene for a mother to have to walk into. So from that point on, obviously, law enforcement, which in this case is the Lake County Police Department, they get involved and they're determined to find out who did this and bring them to justice.
Yes, they found a broken knife outside, and which they suspected of being the murder weapon. And of course, there was just shockwaves throughout the community. So there was enormous pressure to solve this case quickly. And over a month went by without anyone being arrested, but they finally received a tip that an inmate at the Lake County Jail named Juan Rivera had apparently said some incriminating comments about the crime. Rivera was a 19-year-old Puerto Rican immigrant who was currently incarcerated for stealing a car stereo. And he had apparently been saying that he was at a party at the same night Holly was murdered, and that he had seen a man come in who looked like he was sweaty and out of breath and had scratches on him. So they suspected that he might have had an encounter with the killer.
Well, that was Juan's story. He gave it to the police, but I don't think the police believed him. I think this was a case where right from the beginning, they felt like this guy was trying to push the story, the case away from himself. So he invented a character.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, they became initially suspicious when they found out that no party had actually taken place at the house that Juan named on that particular evening. So they finally decided to give him a couple of polygraph tests, but the results were inconclusive. And Juan finally admitted that he had lied about being at a party, that no party had taken place, but he denied that he did anything to Holly Staker. But they decided to bring him in for an interrogation session, and it wound up lasting for 26 straight hours.
Just so people understand, this all kind of happened beginning October 27th of 1992. And then by October 30th, Juan was just falling apart. He had pulled out clumps of his hair. He was banging his head on a wall. And I don't think the police saw this as a man suffering from high stress and despair. I think they saw a man who was breaking down over the guilt that he felt.
Oh, yes, definitely, because it turned out he did have a history of mental illness and depression, and he had attempted suicide a few times in the past, but I don't know if they were aware of that. But he was he only had a 9th grade education, and his IQ was only 79. So he seemed like the ideal candidate who would be very susceptible to police interrogation tactics. So you can only imagine how he was reacting like this after being questioned for nearly 4 straight days. And I know that when he finally made his first confession, they left him alone in a padded room because they were going to prepare a statement for him to sign. And that's when he just started banging his head against the wall and curling up into a fetal position. So I know that the nurse pretty much said that this guy is in no shape to be talking to the police or signing any statements, but they were not swayed by this. They still wanted him to sign a confession they had prepared.
They didn't put him through all of this just to have him slip away. I mean, they had the polygraph testing. They had the hours and hours of interrogation. They had periods of sleep deprivation. They were really working on him to get him to talk.
And what's also crazy is that the first time he signed his confession, they presented it to the state attorney's office, and they were concerned because there were a lot of inaccuracies in it that did not match the detail of the crime. So they actually had to re-interview Juan at a point where he had not slept for 24 hours and also convince him to sign a rights waiver so he wouldn't have an attorney present. And they made him change several details in his confession until they matched the crime accurately. And then he finally signed it and they submitted it to the state's attorney's office to file murder charges.
I just don't understand how this happens. I guess I do, but this really hurts. You have a guy who's sleep deprived, obviously suffering from some mental health issues, and he's being made to sign a confession, which the first confession was full of inaccuracies. They were saying that it might have been up to 80% inaccurate. This is where they compare the statements in the confession to the known facts of the case, and they're just not working. So then, of course, like you said, they get him to sign a second confession that is much more accurate.
I mean, some of the inaccuracies were pretty big because he initially claimed that Holly was wearing a nightgown when he murdered her, but it turned out she was actually wearing regular clothes. I think it was black stretch pants and a multicolored shirt. So they would continue interrogate him and say things like, she had a multicolored shirt on, right? I mean, he didn't really provide any details that were exclusive that only the killer could have known. The details he provided were fed to him by the police. And I know there was another case where he never even mentioned that he strangled Holly, even though she had been found strangled before she was stabbed. So when he finally did find the statement, it was how the police liked it. And they didn't seem to particularly care that he really didn't seem to know anything about the crime.
So let's talk about what his confession said.
Well, I know that I don't know if he's provided like many specific details, but I think he had said he had gone in while Holly was babysitting and then sexually assaulted her and then stabbed her to death. But none of the details he provided were not already public knowledge. And the details that he did provide, which matched the facts of the case, were fed to him by the detectives.
Right. And the details that I could find included him saying that he had purchased two joints and some cocaine that day. He smoked a joint, snorted the cocaine. And then while he was out, he saw Holly standing out in front of this apartment building on Hickory Street. And he said that he recognized Holly because his younger sister had introduced them in the past. And so on this day, she was babysitting the two kids, as you said. And then the boy went out to play, and Juan took the two-year-old sister inside to lay her down because she was tired so she could nap. And that's when he said he and Holly got undressed, but he said he was unable to perform and that Holly started making fun of him. So that's when he grabbed a kitchen knife and started to attack her. And he claims that he wouldn't have kept attacking her had she stopped defending herself, which I don't really understand what that means. But he said that he then put her on a bed and raped her. Then he cleaned up, broke a window with a mop to make it look like there was a break-in, broke the knife and tossed it, and then he just took off. But again, this confession is something that he signed as if it were true.
And it would later turn out that this was pretty much physically impossible because Rivera had a criminal history. He had actually been charged on a previous occasion with stealing a car stereo, and he wound up receiving a sentence of probation and was sentenced to home confinement, which required him to wear an ankle monitor. And one of the reasons he was even in the Lake County Jail to begin with when they questioned him was because he had violated the terms of his home confinement and was thrown back in jail. But they checked the ankle monitor records, and it pretty much showed that he was at home the entire time on the evening of August the 17th. And his parents provided him with an alibi, seeing he was there the whole time. And I know that at the time, Rivera's mother was visiting a relative in Puerto Rico and called him from there and spoke on the phone, which was confirmed by form records. But this did not sway the police. They pretty much came to the conclusion, well, he might have just been able to unplug his ankle monitor and get it off. And then he slipped out, murdered Holly, returned home, and then put the ankle monitor back on, even though these are specifically designed so that they're very difficult to take off without anybody noticing.
This amazes me because this is essentially government property. It has been attached to his body so that they can track him. They can know whether he is operating within the terms that he agreed to. But now they're saying, well, it works except for this window of time.
Exactly. It just seems like a remarkable coincidence that he would just happen to go out on this one night, commit a murder, and then return home and put it back on without anyone noticing. I mean, that really doesn't put much faith in ankle monitors if offenders who are out on home confinement are able to do that.
Well, I don't think we need to spend 2 hours on this part of the case, but Juan is taken to court. Can you lay out what he was charged with?
He was brought into trial and charged with first-degree murder. And all they really had was the confession that he made, because none of the physical evidence from the scene matched him. I don't think they were doing DNA testing back then in 1992, but none of the blood or hair evidence found matched him. And there were a bunch of fingerprints at the apartment, but none of them matched him either. And when he finally went on trial, the only other evidence that they had was two jailhouse informants who claimed they had overheard him making incriminating comments while he was incarcerated. But I know you've talked about that a lot on Generation Y, how that's pretty much the most unreliable evidence when jailhouse informants are providing testimony in a court case.
I do think it can be effective, though, because I think for the average person who hears that, well, this cellmate of the person on trial heard him saying this or was told this by the defendant, etc., that they might think, well, they're in prison, they're going to let stuff slip out because they want to show how, you know, bad they are.
Exactly. Yeah. But we've seen time and time again that a lot of wrongful convictions are made possible by where the only evidence was the story from a jailhouse informant. And a lot of the time they admitted that they lied because they got something in exchange from the police. And I personally think it was desperation, because there was one key piece of evidence which was going to be introduced at his trial before the prosecution backed off at the last minute. Because when Rivera was in jail for the theft of the car stereo, he gave a pair of his shoes to another inmate. I think he traded them for a TV set. And then lo and behold, Rivera's defense was informed that they had found traces of blood on the shoes, which they assumed were connected to the murder. Well, they did their own independent investigation and discovered that Juan had not actually purchased these until after the crime took place. They were able to get a receipt from the Walmart where his mother had purchased them for him. And not only that, but they found out that it would have been impossible to purchase them before or on August the 17th, because they had been manufactured in Hong Kong and were sitting in a distribution warehouse on that date. They had not even been put up for available for sale in the United States. So they started thinking, how is it possible for blood from the crime scene to have wound up on these shoes? And once this was presented to the prosecution, they withdrew them from evidence and they weren't presented at trial.
We've seen this in other wrongful convictions. I mean, I recently spoke with Ronnie Long, who we covered some years ago, and that's where they can literally just present matches, a hat, shoes, what have you. They don't have to link it to the crime. They can just say, what's the likelihood here? We have all this other stuff. We have a confession. We have these other people saying they heard the defendant saying this or confessing that. And now we have these shoes and they have blood on them.
And that's,
they would have used it against him.
And that's what's terrifying about it, is that in this particular case, Juan got very, very lucky that they were able to find documentation that proved he could not have been wearing those shoes when the crime took place, because it seems pretty obvious that the only explanation that this blood could have wound up on the shoes is if someone planted it there. And it's like, that's a type of thing that's very difficult to prove. But in this case, they were able to do it, though they were never able to conclusively find out if the blood was planted, though it certainly seems to be that way.
Well, we mentioned he got taken to court, and I think you already mentioned that there were three trials.
What had happened is that Juan, the first time he went on trial, he was found guilty and received a life sentence, but his defense team appealed the conviction because there were a ton of procedural errors at the trial. So the Illinois Appellate Court decided to overturn the conviction. So Juan went on trial again in 1998, but this time they introduced an additional piece of evidence, which was testimony from Don Engelbrecht's daughter, Taylor, who Holly had been babysitting at the time she was murdered, and it seemed very likely that she was in the apartment and could have possibly seen the killer and witnessed the crime. But the problem is that she was only 2 years old at that time. She was 8 years old when this trial started, but she pointed out Juan in court and said, "This is the man that I saw in the apartment murdering Holly." And it seemed that additional piece of evidence was enough to convince the jury. And that's why Juan was convicted for the second time.
It's unbelievable. I don't know if anybody can recall anything from when they were two. I mean, you might argue, well, this was an event that would be burned into your memory. But we know for a fact that her pointing Juan out was not correct. So how does something like this make it into the court just because no one argues against it?
Yeah, I'm just surprised that it was allowed, because I can think of other trials where they have not allowed testimony from someone that young to be admissible as evidence because their memories are just not reliable. So, and when you consider the fact that the only other evidence is his confession, his questionable confession, it's just surprising that they would put so much stock into the testimony from someone who was only 2 years old when the crime took place.
And I can imagine that she did it for what she thought was a good reason. After all, the authorities are telling her, this is the guy.
I mean, I'm sure she was probably coached during that time period. Even if she legitimately remembered, I'm sure enough people spoke to her by this point that they said, you were there, you saw this guy, and all you have to do is point him out in court.
One thing that's come up over time is that people can create false memories. It's because their brain is filled over and over again with certain images or information, and then it becomes the truth.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure like she legitimately believed it was the truth. I know the satanic panic scandal that took place in the 1980s where a bunch of children felt they had been molested by their daycare providers. I mean, this is along the same lines. These children probably legitimately believed these events happened, but no one questioned their stories, even though they were often very unbelievable.
One thing that I find troubling about this, though, is that these false memories, don't you think they create trauma in these people? So it's sort of like the system is victimizing them for their own purposes.
Exactly. Because, I mean, for all we know, she could have been present and witnessed the murder, but she was so young, that's the type of thing that would escape from her memory. But then she's being told, you did see this horrible, horrible event. And I don't know what this girl is up to today, but I hate to think she has had nightmares or like PTSD from believing that she had witnessed this horrific murder.
Well, let's talk about the third trial, because this is the one that became very, very crucial in this entire case. And up till that point, the prosecution had their way. Now, obviously, there were appeals, things got overturned, but they were convincing juries that Juan Rivera was Holly Staker's killer.
Well, this one, they finally did a DNA testing on the semen sample that had been recovered from the murder scene, and it wound up not matching Juan Rivera. So you think, wow, this is finally going to set him free for good because it proves that he could not have committed this crime. But a prosecuting attorney named Mike Mermel, who was assigned to this case, and he made the decision that he was going to put Juan on trial for the third time in April of 2009. So you have to wonder, how is he going to get past the DNA evidence? Well, he just came up with this theory that Holly Staker, before she was murdered, had consensual sex with another man that same night. And then shortly thereafter, Juan came into the apartment and killed her. But he did not actually rape her this time. He could have raped her and not ejaculated, but he didn't leave his semen behind. So that's why it didn't match him. But he still killed her. And this came across as particularly despicable because Holly Staker was only 11 years old at the time. And now his entire case is based around the fact that he has to present this 11-year-old girl as being sexually active.
And that's what he seemed to do, because he made it sound like she was active.
Yeah, because he actually had to call Holly's twin sister Heather to the stand to testify and recount some bad experiences from their childhood, because apparently there was an incident where she and Holly were sexually abused by one of their brother's friends when they were 8 years old. And she also made Heather recount a story about how Holly had once shown her how to masturbate, because they were just trying to plant the seed into the jury's head that this girl, because of these experiences, could have been sexually active at age 11. And when they tried to like push forward the idea, okay, who is this mysterious man that had relations with Holly before she was murdered? And Mermel would just say, well, no one's going to come forward and admit that they raped an 11-year-old girl. So that's why we don't know who this is. But just ignore that, because Juan Rivera, he's definitely still the real killer.
This is where I'm just speechless. And anybody that does any kind of reading on Mike Mermel will know that this guy is all about getting the win. It doesn't matter if his case makes any sense or not. All he has to do is convince the jury. 12 people. That's it.
And it actually worked, believe it or not, because in spite of the fact that the DNA did not match Juan Rivera, they actually found him guilty for the third time. So I really would love to have been in the jury room when they had their deliberations, because I don't know how they can justify this verdict, because there are 12 people essentially had to say to themselves, I believe this ridiculous theory about her having sex with a completely different person before she was murdered.
I wish more people who were on juries could see this for what it was. I would hope that people would hear what Mike Mermel was saying and think, no, you are now blaming the victim, essentially, like, oh, you're sexually active. So you were having sex, consensual sex. How does an 11-year-old have consensual sex?
I mean, that's why a lot of people objected to this, that he was actually using the term consensual sex in a courtroom as part of his prosecution. But you can't have consensual sex with an 11-year-old because that they're not legally old enough to consent. So it's just kind of horrific that his whole strategy is based on smearing a victim who's dead and is not around to defend herself or refute any of these allegations, but he knows that's the only strategy that's going to work. I've actually heard that there's a legal definition for this when they try the strategy called the unindicted co-ejaculator, because believe it or not, this is not the only case where they have tried this. I know there was another wrongful conviction about a guy named Jeffrey Deskovic, where they found out that the semen in a victim who had been raped and murdered did not match him. And they still gave the same theory that, well, she had sex with another person shortly before she was murdered. So this does not exonerate the defendant.
There's also another case that we covered, Danny Brown, where the prosecution was resting upon two things, one of which was the son of the murder victim ID'd his mother's boyfriend as the killer. But DNA testing showed it was not him, it was not Danny Brown. It was a different man. And the prosecution just went forward, even though the DNA didn't match, and just said, well, the other guy was probably with him, even though there was no connection between the two men.
Which is horrible, because you have to paint these victims as the type of like people who are like cheating on their spouses or like having like sexual contact at a very young age. I mean, all it does is paint the victim in a bad light for no reason whatsoever.
But I wonder if prosecutors that do this even look at it that way, because I know the prosecutor in the Brown case just kept saying, I spoke with that young boy. He was 4 years old and he knew who had killed his mother. So in her mind, she was working towards justice. But again, you're talking to a 4 year old.
I've always wondered that about this particular case with Mike Mermel. Like, did he genuinely believe he was putting a guilty man in prison? Like, did he convince himself that this theory he was presented was true? Or did he just knowingly was trying to secure a conviction at all costs?
Well, I know he was asked in an interview about this, and he said that he's not an advocate for people who are convicted. He said he is hired to get convictions.
Yeah.
So I would say that's a big part of why he did what he did.
Pretty much. And I know that he was once asked in an interview, like how to explain away this DNA evidence. And he pretty much said that DNA doesn't mean much in criminal cases and gave this very weird analogy about how, well, if you have sex in a hotel room, you might wind up rolling over onto the remote control and get your DNA on the remote control. So that could explain like how your DNA could wind up in a place that it's not supposed to. It really didn't make a whole lot of sense. And he was just kind of talking in circles to try to explain how another person's DNA wound up at the murder scene, even though the DNA of the person he says killed her was nowhere to be found.
It's really unbelievable. And he has multiple cases like this. So I would argue that Mermel is more about getting the conviction and less about getting it right, which that's what disturbs us. You know, those of us who are podcasters, those of us who are armchair detectives, this is the kind of behavior we don't want to see, because somewhere deep down, we hope that our system is fair and just, and that everyone's just working towards the truth, even if we're working from different directions.
And that certainly wasn't the case here. And what's interesting is that when they appealed, after Juan was convicted this time, of course, his defense appealed the conviction yet again. And when they sent it to the appeals court, one of the things they brought up was that the prosecution introducing Holly Staker's sex life during the trial violated the rape steal statute. The rape shield statute is generally invoked by the prosecution in rape trials in order to prevent the defense from introducing a victim's past sexual behavior into evidence. But this was the rare case where the defense was invoking the statute in order to prevent the prosecution from introducing a victim's alleged sexual behavior into evidence. So it pretty much turned the entire system upside down because it was such an extraordinary circumstance.
So the third trial, what was the result of this third trial?
Well, it actually ended up with Juan being found guilty again. And he got another life sentence. He was sent back to prison. And when the appellate court of Illinois heard the case, they looked at all these arguments about the rape shield statute and all the misconduct in this case. And finally, in December of 2011, they finally decided to overturn Juan's conviction for the third and final time. And this time, they actually took the step of barring prosecutors from ever trying Rivera for the same crime again. They basically put their foot down and said, no matter what you dream up, you are not bringing this person into trial for murder ever again. So finally, he became a free man for the first time. But by this point, he had gone through three trials and had spent 19 years in prison.
Thank goodness that they reversed this, because again, we're just trying to get to the truth. And the best way to get to the truth is through forensic evidence. This idea that you can come up with, you know, some strange way or reason that his ankle monitor wouldn't record him leaving, and that he would suddenly know all these details of the case and get them right on his second confession. I mean, there's so much at work here that shows that this was a manipulation from day one. I know Juan had assistance from the Northwestern University Center on Wrongful Convictions. Didn't they represent him at court? In wrongful conviction cases, there are always attorneys or wrongful conviction groups that aid these people quite a bit and help them earn their freedom.
On Rivera's third conviction, the lead attorney was Lawrence C. Marshall, a Stanford University law professor and co-founder of the Center on Wrongful Convictions. And he was joined by co-counsel from Jenner and Block, LP, and the center. So he definitely took a vested interest in this case.
And we've seen wrongful conviction groups popping up all over the country, also known as Innocence Projects. And they do amazing work. They have attorneys, they have law students, they have university students, and they all work together to free people who have been wrongfully convicted.
I mean, this was definitely the case. I know a lot of these innocence projects receive a lot of requests from convicted inmates, and there's no way that they could possibly get to all of them, unfortunately. But I'm sure there was something about Juan Rivera's case that just really stuck out to the Lawrence C. Marshall, especially when he found out that the DNA testing had exonerated him and they were still planning to take him to trial for a third time. And I think he pretty much decided, I have to get involved in this and get this guy out of prison.
They needed to do something, and actually making it to where the prosecution couldn't come back in and do this all over again. That was justice finally, but only half justice, because in this case, it was justice for Juan Rivera, but we're still left with Holly Staker was raped and murdered and her killer is free.
And this leads us to a crazy side story about this, because they finally decided to enter the DNA found at the murder scene into a database. And it turned out that this same DNA was found at another murder, which took place in January of 2000. And this involved the murder of a 39-year-old resident in Chicago named Delwin Foxworth, where three intruders broke into his home, tied him up at gunpoint, and demanded that he hand over some money. And when Foxworth refused to comply, they proceeded to beat him with a 2x4, poured gasoline on him, and then set him on fire before fleeing the scene. And he somehow managed to douse the flames and survive, but he had burns on over 80% of his body, and he pretty much lived in hell for the next 2.5 years from all the pain before he died, because they left such a devastating effect. But what's interesting is that a couple years later, in 2003, a suspect named Marvin Tyrone Williford was charged with Delwyn Foxworth's murder, and there was no physical evidence linking him to the crime, but Foxworth's girlfriend was apparently a witness and claimed that Foxworth had owed him a debt, and that was his motive for killing him like this. So he wound up being convicted and securing an 80-year prison sentence. But this is where it gets complicated, because they found blood on the 2x4, which had been used to beat Foxworth, and it did not match Foxworth, and it did not match Marvin Tyrone Williford. But the problem is that Williford claims that because his DNA doesn't match, he's innocent of the crime, but it technically doesn't exonerate him, because there were three people there, and two of these other people have never been arrested. So for all we know, one of those two people might be Holly Staker's killer, but they have still never been identified.
In other words, they had the evidence they needed to at least go in the right direction on this case. But you wonder if once they started down a certain path, they just couldn't turn around.
Oh, exactly. I mean, this is pretty much the most glaring thing of all, is that another murder was convicted while Juan Rivera was in prison, which means that if they had done their investigative job the first time around, they could have caught this killer before Delwyn Foxworth was murdered. Like, this person was allowed to remain free and commit more crimes. And it's particularly frustrating, because Marvin Tyrone Williford, for all we know, he could be innocent and was wrongfully convicted as well. But if he was actually guilty, all they would really have to do is solve this case is approach Williford and say, who are your other two accomplices when you committed this crime? And game over.
So obviously there are some issues that this case highlights, one of which is the interrogation technique used. You know, they like to tout that this detective has a 96% success rate when interrogating suspects, etc. And they hold it up as if it's some great stat. And the same goes for the prosecution. The prosecution can say, oh, we are successful this much percent of the time. It's usually something really high. But what is it really telling us? The true story of what it says is it's not necessarily a good thing. It might be that they're just good at manipulating things. They're good at manipulating people, whether it's a jury or a suspect.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and that's the problem in this case, is that they were under such pressure to solve this murder that once Juan Rivera came into their lap and shared this incriminating story, they pretty much decided he's the guy, and we don't care if the evidence leads elsewhere or the evidence shows that he could not have done it. It's pretty much, we have a guy in our custody, and if we interrogate him far enough, he will make a confession. But the way that they acted afterwards in the next 2 decades clearly showed that they did not care that the right person had been put in prison for this crime.
So what happened with Juan Rivera? Before we get back to the rest of the case, what happened with Juan Rivera after he was set free?
Well, obviously, he filed a wrongful conviction lawsuit, and he wound up getting awarded a settlement of $20 million, which at that point was the largest amount ever awarded for a wrongful conviction in the history of the United States. I think that record has since been broken, but at the time, awarding $20 million for a wrongful conviction was pretty high. But I think anyone who has studied this case will say that he deserves every penny for what he went through.
That's true. When I think about the amount of money that he was given, I think back to statements I've made in the past on Generation Y, one of which, I think I've said this a number of times, when you make the system pay a ton of money, it will give them pause in the future. But I don't think that's a fair statement or an accurate statement anymore, because I think about Mike Mermel, and I think about how he has never wavered on his belief that Juan Rivera is the killer of Holly Staker. And so it doesn't matter how much the system has to pay out. When you have a prosecutor or a detective who has double down on their suspect, on their theory of the case, I don't think anything can change their minds.
And that's what's scary, is that I don't see any indication that Mike Mermel faced any consequences for this. I mean, he had his reputation kind of destroyed, and because of all the public pressure from this, all the controversy, he was forced to retire. But by that point, he had already had a long career as a prosecutor, so it's not like he was disbarred or anything. He got to have a comfortable retirement, and this $20 million that was awarded to Juan, that's not coming out of his pocket. That's coming out of taxpayers. So I've seen cases like this before. I don't know if you covered this on Generation Y, but another man named Anthony Graves, who was wrongfully convicted and spent mm-hmm. 2 decades on death row. And it was so clear that the prosecutor in that case had fabricated and withheld evidence, which proved Graves was innocent. And once he was exonerated and released from prison, they finally decided to disbar the prosecutor. But the problem is that he was already retired at that point. So the punishment really didn't suit the crime. It didn't really affect him all that much. And to this day, he still runs a website and continues to maintain that he was right all along and that Anthony Graves was guilty. So he still has the same attitude as Michael Mermel.
People have ideas about how to fix the system. And I don't want to say that the whole system's broken, but it's only as good as the people who are operating within it at the time. And we see here what we get when we have people like this prosecutor in this case. You know, they're essentially wasting taxpayers' dollars and preventing the victim and their family from ever achieving justice. And this is something I hope that most people understand, but just because you get a conviction and you get someone put away, that's not necessarily justice. It's only justice if you've shown that this person is actually the killer. And when you have the DNA evidence, as well as all the buildup of the sleep deprivation, the long hours of interrogation, I mean, it's essentially 4 days of torture. These things don't add up to justice. They just add up to, we can break a guy who has an IQ of 79.
And what's particularly heartbreaking is that after Rivera was released from prison, they did an interview with Holly's twin sister, Heather, and she still believed he was guilty. She pretty much said, why would you confess to a crime if you didn't do it? So from day one, she was convinced that because Rivera had confessed, then there's no other explanation. No one would falsely confess to a crime that they didn't commit. So as far as I know, she might still believe he was the killer to this day, but it just puts the victim's family through an emotional wringer where they become convinced that justice was served and they found the right guy. But then it keeps going through the courts and you have convictions overturned until the person you believed murdered your loved one is set free from prison. And then you pretty much find out that they're going to make no effort to find the real killer. That's just such a horrible ordeal for the family.
And I've seen this in other cases. I've seen where we'll get an email and it'll be from a family. They saw that the convicted was set free by a court and they write in to say that they disagree with us. They'll say that person is the person who murdered my sister, brother, aunt, whatever. And I don't know what to say to them because I understand they're looking at this in a different way than I am. I'm a lot more objective because I'm on the outside. I don't have a dog in the fight. I just want to know the truth. That doesn't make me better than them. But I think that family members can be vulnerable in cases like this because they trust law enforcement. They trust the courts. And when you have the prosecutor saying, we're taking him down, we will get him in prison, your loved one will have justice, they start putting all their eggs in that basket. And if that basket hits the ground, I mean, it's like everyone has to suffer all over again. And it's just too bad that some of these families never realize that, well, they were lied to.
Pretty much. I mean, this is one case where like the evidence that Juan Rivera didn't do it is just so overwhelming that you wonder how could Holly's family still believe he was the guilty party? But you just kind of put yourself in their shoes where you're given all this information from law enforcement and prosecuting attorneys that they got the right guy and you have no reason to disbelieve them. And I guess it might be their comfort zone because it's better to believe that the killer did at least serve 19 years in prison rather than thinking that the real killer actually got away with it and has received no punishment whatsoever.
And that's understandable. Again, I haven't been in their position. It's just on the outside looking in. I think this is really unfortunate. And I don't put the blame anywhere but on the prosecutor in this case. it was up to the prosecutor to see what kind of case that they had. And I'll give them this. I think without properly understanding mental health issues, understanding someone's true background, I can see where they were looking at Juan Rivera and thinking, everything you're doing is telling us that you did this, that you're the guilty party. So I get why they focused on him. But I would just love to see a prosecutor who can switch gears. And we recently covered a case on our Patreon where we talked about a prosecutor who did do that and did switch gears and said, you know what? I see this now. I'm going to do this. I will make an agreement. We'll get a deal worked out. And we just don't see that often enough, at least in the cases that we cover.
Oh, exactly. And another frustrating element for this is that the murder is solvable because they have DNA evidence. Because if there was someone in power who really wanted the real killer to face justice, as we've seen in recent years, that all you have to do is enter DNA into a genetic genealogy database, and they have DNA here, and it might lead you to the perpetrator. But I've seen no indication that they've done that in this case, and they probably never will, unless they face considerable public pressure. But out of all the cases I've covered on The Trail Went Cold that are still unsolved, this seems like one of the most solvable because of that DNA evidence. But they would then have to admit that they made a mistake and put the wrong person in prison. And it sounds like the people in power are reluctant to do that.
Most probably because of ego.
How differently would things have turned out if they were unable to prove that the blood on the shoes, which supposedly belonged to the victim, that Rivera was not wearing the shoes at the time the murder took place, because they were able to turn out receipts that showed that he did not purchase them until after Holly's murder. But I kept thinking that if they were unable to prove that, that would have been just such a major hurdle to overcome and overturn his conviction, because you have the victim's blood on the shoes, and you could say that someone planted it there, but you can't prove it. And you kind of think of how many other cases are there out there where people have planted evidence and they've just been unable to prove it. But I think they realize that if we take this particular case for a guy who has been cleared by DNA evidence, there's no way that he's going to get convicted at his third trial. But unfortunately, that turned out to be the case. But they didn't stop fighting for him until they finally got him out of prison for good.
Well, I also think about, what if they had lost the DNA evidence, the semen that was collected? What if that was gone? Might he still be in prison?
Possibly, because, I mean, the first time his conviction was overturned was because of procedural errors at the trial, but he got convicted a second time based on the eyewitness testimony of the 2-year-old girl. If they hadn't have been able to do DNA testing, I don't know what other method they might have used to get his conviction overturned the third time. So they were lucky in that respect that they had concrete physical evidence that they could use to get him out of prison for good.
I didn't know if you wanted to take a little time and talk about CrimeCon.
Well, this will be, I've been to CrimeCon the first 3 years it took place, 2017, 2018, 2019, and of course was planning to go last year in Orlando when it was canceled because of COVID. I was hoping to go to Austin this year in 2021, but because the Canada-US border is closed to non-essential travel at this time, I probably won't be able to enter the country, so I'm going to have to miss it, but I am confident that I'll be able to travel internationally by the time CrimeCon UK comes around in September. And I'm definitely looking forward to it because I have relatives from England. And I remember visiting there a few times when I was a really little kid with my parent. But I don't think I've been to England for over 30 years. So I'm looking forward to going back.
I would say that some of your listeners would argue that it would be essential travel. But as far as England goes, on September 25th and 26th is when CrimeCon UK is happening. And Justin and I were just in the UK in 2019, and I had never been before. He had never been there before. And despite the uncomfortable trip, because we're kind of tall, I guess, and planes are made for people under 5'10", I think, it was an amazing time. And the country is just incredible. I love all the buildings, the streets. Pretty much every person we interacted with out there was just a great human being. And, you know, one of the great memories I have of being in England was I went to a pub with Ben from They Walk Among Us, and we were having some Guinness, and we were watching the women's national team, the soccer team, play in the championship. And so we got to see them win. That was pretty exciting.
That's cool. I mean, I'm not a soccer fan, but to be able to witness that with a large crowd of enthusiastic fans, that sounds like it would be a great experience.
Yeah, I hadn't watched any soccer since I think I played it back when I was young. But just watching the talent level and then just the competitiveness between them, and I think it was the Netherlands. And then, of course, the entire crowd was behind the American team, which was great. So it was a great time. But of course, if anybody's wondering, should I make the trip to England? Well, I would encourage you, there's no better time than to go to CrimeCon. And as far as Austin's concerned, I've been to Texas a few times, and I don't think I've spent any real time there. So I'm looking forward to that. But what do you think of when someone says, what's CrimeCon like? What do you want them to know before they go?
Well, I always say that you're finally around people that you can that understand your obsession with true crime. It really feels like you're at home, because I know it's always been a joke for so many years where you would have to keep your obsession with true crime a secret around regular people because they would think you were weird. But you go to CrimeCon and you're surrounded by like-minded individuals. And it was such an exciting experience the first time I went in Indianapolis in 2017, and I had people coming up to me who were big fans of The Trail Went Cold, who were excited to meet me and were stopping me for selfies and stuff. It's like when you're a podcaster, you kind of feel like a celebrity for one weekend out of the year before you go back to your normal life. But while you're there, you kind of feel like royalty, and it's just kind of flattering. And that's why I'm excited for CrimeCon UK, because for years, I've had a number of British listeners tell me, when is CrimeCon coming over here? I want to finally go to one of these events. I want to meet my favorite podcasters. And now you'll finally get the opportunity. And I know that there are a lot of excellent UK true crime podcasts out there who have never been able to make the trip to North America for CrimeCon, but now they finally get a chance to go to their own event and meet some of America and Canada's best crime podcasters, meeting up with some of Britain's best true crime podcasters for the first time. So it'll be an exciting experience.
As well as Ireland's.
Oh yes, Ireland's as well. Yes.
But the other thing is too, it's an amazing time because when you're there, you don't know if you're going to meet a new best friend or if you'll have a really interesting conversation with a podcaster or an FBI agent. You just never know. But I'll say this, even for the podcasters, we love the conversations. We love meeting people. And so we're feeling just what you feel. You think you're meeting Robin Warder, big deal. But for us, we feel the same way about meeting all of you.
It was like such an awe-inspiring experience the first time I went to CrimeCon and met like so many people from different parts of the U.S. and outside the U.S. as well. There were a few people who came from international countries and were telling me that they listened to my podcast and were just such huge fans. And that's the thing, is the way Podcast Row works is that you stand at a table for a couple hours every day and have a meet and greet with your fans and chat with them. And then after all the events are done, you just go out at the bar for the evening and just kind of mingle and interact with your fans and fellow podcasters. And it's such a fun experience because you're around people, like-minded individuals who have your same interests.
Now, do you recall meeting me at CrimeCon?
Yes, I did. Yes. I think I introduced myself to you on Podcast Row, and it was kind of funny. You didn't know me yet. I don't even know if you had heard of The Trail Went Cold before I introduced myself to you, but I know that it caught you and Justin's attention when I mentioned that I drove 12 hours from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada to Indianapolis just to be there, and I may have been the only Canadian person there on that particular year. But I remember Justin saying to me that, oh, you're very polite. You're just how I pictured Canadians would be.
Since then, I had checked out your show. And one thing that really caught my attention, though, was the amount of articles that you had written that were just out on the internet.
Yes, for about 3 years before I started my own podcast, I used to write articles for crack.com and listverse.com. And I know ListFirst, their particular audience loves true crime stuff. They love articles about unsolved mysteries. And so I would publish all these articles, like 10 unsolved missing persons cases with bizarre clues. And from what the administrator of ListFirst told me, they always got some of the best traffic. And I was kind of building up a following. And eventually got to the point where I wanted to take the next step, where I wanted to go more in depth into some of these cases that I wrote about, because I'd only write maybe like a 300-page summary of them in each article, but I wanted to learn more, especially since some of these cases were pretty obscure and no one had heard of them. So that's kind of how I came up with the idea of The Trail Went Cold, where I would do a different unsolved cold case every single week. And if you go back and look at some of my old articles at Cracked or Listverse, you'll find so many cases I wrote about which have since been featured on The Trail Went Cold.
And what, when you think back to your younger days, what do you think inspired you to have this fascination with mystery and crime?
Oh, definitely Unsolved Mysteries, the TV show. I'm old enough that I remember watching it on TV when it first started in the late 1980s when I was just a kid. And then I followed it throughout the 90s till the show went off the air. And at the time I started The Trail Went Cold, you couldn't really watch Unsolved Mysteries episodes anywhere. Like anytime they uploaded them to YouTube, they would get taken down immediately for copyright reasons. So I kind of figured, that's kind of what I do on The Trail Went Cold, is I cover a lot of cases which were originally featured on Unsolved Mysteries. And I'm so happy to see that there's kind of been a rejuvenation in the show in recent years, because now you can watch all the seasons on YouTube and Amazon Prime. And they've since did a Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix and launched a new podcast. So you can tell that there is still a huge market for this show from people who love it.
And you and I, of course, would point back to Robert Stack simply because he had the voice, he had the look, he had the trench coat. But really, the stories are so fascinating, and they would go from UFOs to some sort of weird lake creature to an unsolved murder, all kinds of different cases. And so it was a perfect fit for someone like you or someone like myself.
Yeah, I will admit that when I was younger, I was most fascinated by the ghost and UFO stories. But as I got older, I got more interested in the true crime ones. And that's kind of why I started The Trail Went Cold. I would go back and watch these old segments that aired 30 years ago and then find out that the case was still unsolved after all this time. So I figured I'd like to do a more in-depth look into this case on the podcast. And they really did very well at picking a lot of their cases, because some of them are really baffling mysteries where you just cannot come up with a solution for what might have happened.
Yeah, I'm just so into the pros and cons of all these different formats. And obviously, we work in audio format, but it has the benefit of us being able to go into more detail. Whereas the visual format, such as a TV show or a documentary, you get to see the players. And I think it helps inform the audience in a different way about the cases. But I think the best way to deal with any of these cases is, of course, to listen about them and watch them.
Oh, exactly. Because there's only a limited amount of information you can put in a TV show that airs on a network and a time slot. But we podcasters have a lot of creative freedom. And that was kind of one of my initial brainstorms, where I thought I would cover cases that were featured on Unsolved Mysteries, but I would dig up additional information that you did not learn in the original segment. And a lot of other podcasters have done the same thing. They seek to give more well-rounded looks at some of these cases.
And I know you're really into mysteries as well. Has there been a mystery, even one perhaps that you haven't covered yet, that fascinates you?
It was actually the subject of my very first episode of The Trail Went Cold. And if you watch Unsolved Mysteries on YouTube today, it's on the very first episode hosted by Robert Stack. But it's the death of a woman named Aileen Conway, a housewife and mother who lived in Lawton, Oklahoma. And she was killed in a flaming car crash on a lonely dirt road about 15 miles away from her home. And even though it was initially ruled to be an accident, her husband did not believe it, because there were just so many bizarre clues. Because on the day that she was killed, he returned home and found out that she had left the iron on, that a garden hose was running into the pool, she had left the bathtub filled up, and the phone was off the hook. So it seemed unusual that she would have just decided to go out for a drive and get into an accident. And she had never been out to that area on that lonely dirt road. And they eventually uncovered evidence that suggested that she had been the victim of arson, but even after 30 years, we're no closer to solving this, thinking, okay, if she was murdered, who did it? What was the motive? And how did she wind up in her car on this lonely dirt road and get burned so badly in a case of arson? It's just one of those cases where no matter how hard you rack your brain trying to come up with an airtight theory, you just can't.
I'm much like you. I think when I was younger and I watched Unsolved Mysteries, I was waiting, hoping that I would see video evidence of aliens or ghosts or what have you. But as time has gone on, I look back at the cases they've covered that were crime related, and they stand out as even being more interesting.
And what's great is that a lot of these older cases that were featured on Unsolved Mysteries are now getting solved thanks to DNA. Just a couple days before we recorded this, they announced an arrest in the case of Roger Dean, a guy who was killed inside his home in an apparent kidnapping and extortion attempt from a masked man. And the gunman made a fatal mistake because he left his mask behind at the scene. And back in 1985, he probably didn't think it was going to be any big deal, but they extracted DNA from that mask and entered into a genetic genealogy database, and it eventually led to a suspect named Michael Jefferson, who has just been arrested 36 years after the crime took place.
Yeah, I think back to the Golden State Killer, and you know there are people out there that have committed crimes who think they've gotten away with it, but you know, that's the hope we have now. We're seeing cases closed, solved after decades.
Like, I remember watching some of these Unsolved Mysteries cases on TV like 20, 30 years ago and thinking they would never be solved. But now, because someone may have left their DNA behind, any case is solvable. And I'm seeing resolutions in these cases I grew up watching. It's still pretty surreal.
And I know I've been asked this. I don't know how you feel about it, but I've had people ask me if a case is unsolved for a long time and all of a sudden it is solved and we get an answer, does it ever feel like a letdown in a way, because the mystery was so great and there were theories, there were discussions. But I know, speaking for myself, one of the things that draws me to true crime is justice. And I don't care what the story is. If they can prove what happened in a case, they can bring someone to justice, I think it's the best outcome there is.
Oh, yeah. Like, I definitely agree 100%, because even though these might be intriguing mysteries, you have to remember that there are victims in these stories and that they have families and friends who are looking for a resolution in these cases. So no matter how much time has passed, if they're able to solve them and bring the perpetrator to justice, then that's only a good thing.
Have you had contact post-episode with family members of cases you've discussed?
Yes, a few times. And I won't say who it was, but there was one case I released an episode for a couple years ago involving a father and son who disappeared together. And there was some ambiguity because the father's girlfriend at the time had been murdered, and they weren't sure if he had killed her and gone on the run with his son, or if maybe both of them were victims from an unknown third party who had gotten rid of the body. And after I released my episode, I heard from the child's biological mother, who has been seeking justice for nearly 30 years now. And she thanked me for keeping the case alive by featuring it on the podcast. And she gave me some information which had not been released publicly, which finally gave me more of an idea about what likely happened. And I'm still kind of hoping that they can still solve this thing, because we have two missing people and one unsolved murder. And it's very apparent that someone has gotten away with it for a very long time.
I always appreciate hearing from family members. And, you know, fortunately, most of them have been very praiseworthy of us, or at least appreciative of us. I've had a few complaints. One was a recent case involving the death of a young guy, and his brother wrote in and was very upset with us about the way we covered it. When you're dealing with people who are emotionally tied into a case, they may not understand why you cover something a certain way. And Justin and I, while we're not advocates, we wouldn't describe ourselves that way, we still like to hold prosecutors to a certain standard. And we would like to see a certain level of evidence. And so if it feels like they're getting away with just creating a story rather than presenting evidence, we're going to call them out on it. Either way, I still appreciate people writing in because it means they're listening and they gave it a chance.
Exactly. I mean, because my podcast exclusively covers unsolved cold cases, I think that there is an appreciation from them that that these cases are still being remembered and getting out there, and because there is still a chance they could be solved. But I'm sure there's some families out there who would prefer to move on with their life and not have people still talking about these cases after all these years because the memories are too painful. But most of the time, the reactions are positive.
And I don't know if you've had a chance to speak with any true crime authors, but I know some of them have taken quite a bit of heat for covering cases where family members said, "It's not your story. We're trying to move on, and you're bringing it all up again."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can understand that, especially with solved cases. I know that can be kind of a controversial thing for both authors and podcasters, where the story is technically solved and the case is closed and there's nowhere else really to go. And I think sometimes the families would prefer to move on, but people still want to tell these stories in book or podcast form. And then you can kind of understand why the families would feel that way.
Well, I think in our own way, we're all storytellers, and we need to tell the stories, and these are just the stories that we want to talk about. We think there are lessons in there. We think there are warnings in there. And so we'll always be interested in telling these stories as long as we have voices, I imagine.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, that's the thing, is that as long as you do it respectfully and very nice to the victims, because that's also an important thing, that if someone was the victim of a horrific crime, they should not be forgotten, even if their killer is caught and put away. And I always have the mentality to focus more on the victims themselves than the actual killers, because they're the ones who deserve to be remembered.
We definitely strive for that. And it was interesting because we recently were contacted by a listener who was just a little upset with us, just a little bit, just because we had named a recent episode after the killer. And I honestly did it because I didn't think anyone would be able to pronounce the name of the victim.
Oh.
So I don't know if you ever have that where you're like, well, I'm going to name it this, or if you just straight up have a process you do, and as part of that, you're only naming it after the victim, et cetera.
Well, pretty much, because in most of these cases, we don't even know who the killer was. So you kind of have to name the episode after the victim as a necessity. I guess there are some situations where you'll call it, if say the Orange Sock Murders, if it's multiple victims rather than the names themselves. But I still most of the time name the episodes after the person who was the victim in the story.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you at a future CrimeCon, hopefully CrimeCon UK this September.
Yes, definitely. I'm looking forward to seeing you again. We've hung out a lot at a lot of these past events, but I haven't seen you in person for nearly 2 years now. So I'm looking forward to a reunion.
Well, we did hang out in Toronto, did we not?
Yes, which was August of 2019. We were on stage together for a live show, but I think that's the last time I've seen you face to face.
I think we did have a lunch or something.
Yes, yes. We had a get together at Christie's house as well.
I hope you have a great evening, and it's always a pleasure to speak with you, Robin.
Oh, definitely. My pleasure. It was great to record an episode for the first time.
Take care, Robin.
Okay, have a good night. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope to meet some of you listeners in person at CrimeCon UK this September. And I guess my final statement is, I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this special episode. As someone who listened to Generation Y long before I started The Trail Went Cold, and I've always cited it as one of my biggest influences, it was a pleasure to sit down and record an episode with Aaron, and I hope to see him and Justin again at CrimeCon UK in just over 3 months. Remember, if you would like to purchase tickets to the event, it is taking place at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. We have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount off tickets, so please visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. Hope to see you there.